Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in. Because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm the Big Mike, Mike Zlotnik. Today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome Darren Smith. Hi, Darren.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining the podcast. Darren has flipped a couple hundred houses, and he is a specialist now in small industrial real estate investing. That is a interesting area. I think industrial has been picking up in the recent few years, kind of this post-COVID world. Industrial is a good world. Before it was a scary word. Now people love warehouses and that kind of stuff. So before we go there, Darren, would you be so kind as to tell us a little bit about you, your family, you know, married, kids, cats, pets, dogs? I don't know.
Sure, Mike. So I'll make it quick, but graduated in 1997, went off in the Army and kind of did the computer world after that for about 18 years. That overlapped with real estate since 2003 and got married a little bit thereafter. And we now have a 7-month-old boy that we're very happy with, having all sorts of fun and living in New York, Pennsylvania.
Congratulations and thank you for your service. That's awesome. And you said you live where? What part of Pennsylvania?
Right now we live in York, Pennsylvania, but I have, besides middle school and high school, I've never lived anywhere than more than 4 years. So bounce around quite a bit.
I think I've driven through York, Pennsylvania. I guess it's a small town America, right?
That's it, right between Harrisburg and Baltimore, about 2 hours west of Philly.
Gotcha. Yeah, very cool. So let's talk a little bit about this. Let's just go back to the basics. Explain what is an industrial investment. Is it a warehouse? Is it a body shop for cars, repairs? What is typically, who is the tenant?
Sure. It's a great question. And I mean, the answer can be as diverse, you know, in multifamily, you can have everything from, you know, a trailer park to the plaza in New York City. I mean, so there's obviously a wide diversity of what can be included in that class. What I focus on specifically is the 3 to 50,000 square foot. And I prefer the light industrial, but industrial is also a great asset class. And really the difference just is how heavy does it get into, you know, where they might be dealing with, you know, chemicals and heavy industry. I mean, industrial could include, you know, an oil production plant. So, I mean, you can go all the way to that extreme of something, and I don't deal with that. It's a lot of just warehouses or smaller manufacturer. One of them, property owners, they make cabinetry. So, you know, kitchens and that type of stuff, and then sell them.
Interesting. Very interesting. So small industrial, typically local businesses, right? This is not Amazon buying a distribution or renting a massive distribution warehouse. It's not 200,000 square feet. It's smaller, local, usually locally owned or not. Well, I guess owned and operated businesses. And like you said, you're staying away from the heavy industrial into more of, furniture production or something else.
That's it. And it usually is smaller, you know, single tenant type places. Not necessarily though. I mean, I have one tenant that's, it's the U.S. government, actually it's the Army Corps of Engineers, and they're in a 23,000 square foot warehouse. So depending on, you know, what these companies need, especially like you say in Amazon, they're doing a lot more. I don't have any Amazon, but they do a lot of kind of last mile stuff. So maybe Amazon might have a 1 million square foot warehouse, but then surrounding them, you're going to have a lot of smaller warehouses from the companies that support them, that deliver to them or provide them services.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It actually, the service around the big players is always, you know, kind of the crumbs fall off, and these crumbs are big enough for the local players. So.
They certainly are, especially for someone, you know, small time like me. I'm very happy with those crumbs.
So let's talk about the economics of these things. So how do you typically find them? What kind of cap rates they trade at? What, you know, how do people invest into that? Is financing available? What kind of financing? Are banks happy to lend on these type of properties?
Yeah, all great questions. The marketing side of it, I took a lot of the same skill set from my single family investing business, and I carried that over into this. So I do mailers, I have a cold caller, and we pull data from different sources. There's CoStar, there's Reonomy. You pull that data, and then we just market the same. I would say I use a higher class of marketing. So I make sure I'm using a US person for the calling. The cards are, they actually have a pen where it handwrites the address and handwrites the card. So it's very much more custom. I put my business card in, you know, it's more expensive, but it works really well. As far as the cap rates you're looking at, that's exactly what drew me to the industrial side in the first place, was coming from the single family and small multifamily world. The next logical step for the vast majority of people is to go into larger and larger multifamily. And I know many people who have been very, very successful in that business and they do well. But honestly, they're all a lot smarter than me. And I wasn't going to try and compete with that. And the cap rates, the challenges in that business, everybody is aware of it. Everybody's competing with it. And so they kept driving cap rates lower and lower and lower. And I thought that's not a game that I wanted to play. So I looked around at office, retail, and industrial, dabbled around in each a little bit, and then landed on industrial. It's one I really like. It's a little bit simpler to understand. It can get extremely complicated, like I said, an oil production facility or something. But for the most part, it's a single tenant or a couple tenants in your building. It's a shell, so there's less functionality. I have a 36,000 square foot office building as well. And when I look through that, all the utilities and mechanicals and everything else involved, it is way, way more complicated than a similar size industrial building that I have. So that's why I like that. The cap rates I found on average are a point or two higher than what I was finding on the multifamily side. As you mentioned, though, COVID has changed that. I like that COVID has made my buildings worth more, but I really don't like COVID because it has brought a way more attention to the industrial space, which I'm continuing to do as I talk to you. But it has made it more of a challenge to find properties to buy at a good value.
So let's talk about actual pricing. I mean, the cap rate. So what is the cap rate? What's the going cap rate today? And the good news is what you bought in the past is now more valuable because of the attention. But today, if you were to find a new deal, what kind of a cap rate would you acquire it at?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm finding a little bit more off market. So for me, what it might go for if you listed with a broker, paid all the fees, you know, waited for however long it takes to sell, I see very, you know, class A properties. And that, again, that's probably more the 20 to 50,000 square foot range where they have long-term tenants, solid, you know, solid backing and underwriting done on them. They can go as low as like a 6 cap now, or even lower. I've seen some 5.5s in really hot areas.
That's a class A. B and C's? What kind of cap rates they trade?
B and C. I mean, I would probably, you know, step up, 2 points on each. So B would be about, you know, I'm seeing like 8 to 9, and then by the time you get, you know, C, I would need to be in at least a 10 cap. And that really, I'm still looking. You know, if I'm in some remote building in the middle of nowhere and there's not a lot of tenants around, I'm even going much higher. Like if it's an older building, I may have to be at a 15 cap or something before I touch something like that. But where I'm liking to buy, I don't like to go low end. I'm not a classy multifamily investor, and I'm not a classy industrial investor either. So I like that middle where most of my stuff is in that 8 to 10 range is about where I'm at. And banks love those, by the way, as well. That was one of your other questions. I'm very easily able to get 70% bank loans on these properties. And that I use the rest of either partners' funds or my own, or sometimes I'm even able to pay the seller a little bit more if they're willing to hold even a second on the property. That's another strategy they can use to get the seller extra money.
Yeah, this is really cool. If you compare that to Class B multifamily, the cap rates on industrial are still substantially higher. And I guess cash on cash is a lot better. So it's one of the few asset classes. Again, this is, I guess, your neck of the woods. Are most of your properties in rural Pennsylvania? Is it where they are, or are they all over the map?
Yeah, and that's definitely what you want to caveat this with for your listeners is I invest in South Central and Southeastern Pennsylvania. So I do have properties over closer to Philly, Harrisburg, and the metropolitan areas I'm looking at have a couple hundred thousand people. But the information is it all based on this area. And some of the properties I do have are kind of remote. I mean, Chambersburg and the Franklin County area, definitely much smaller than say Harrisburg or Philly.
Yeah, and it makes sense. Again, small town America, it's kind of the basics, and there's nothing wrong with this. In fact, people are there, they have businesses, it's lower cost of operation, right? And they can manufacture less expensively there, U.S. made, right? In theory, you can do a lot of U.S. made in USA, right? Good old. I don't know if you can compete with China, but if you're in a small town in America, maybe at least there's some competitive, you know.
There is, and but there are still like massive companies here. I mean, we just had a 1 million square foot Chewy, the dog, you know, food supply company, right here in York, Pennsylvania. They're spec building industrial buildings up along 83 and 81 close to here that are 500,000, 1 million, 2 million square foot of these buildings that are going up in the area. So there's a lot of industry that does happen even in these rural small towns that you probably, you know, haven't heard of.
Well, I mean, we have a cat. We don't have a dog, but I could tell you that the cat is hungry every day. So I think the cat food and the dog food needs to be manufactured somewhere, right? And they ain't going to pay New York City rent. So they got to pay what I feel that, you know, maybe in any big city. So at the end of the day, is they need to have a plant and a facility. And you can be a couple hundred of miles away from the big cities, but you can make it a whole lot cheaper. So
that's exactly it. And that's kind of my sales pitch. You work with a lot of, you know, private money, and I do the same when purchasing of my properties. And that's kind of it. I can show, you know, the growth. I look for areas, you know, wherever you're investing that have at least some level of population growth in the area. I mean, I found phenomenal deals in the area, but if I look back and I see over the last 10 years, they've dropped, you know, 3% in population. That's a dying market. I don't want to be chasing that. But if they're going up a couple of percentage, I like that because I know there's always going to be some level of growth to that market. I look at the unemployment rate, the crime statistics, and I provide all that to my investors as well, the people that partner with me, to show them how their money is secured and the properties we're purchasing for the long term.
Makes sense. So how do you partner with people? Just curious. So I think these type of projects, I guess class B is when the, you know, cap rates in the, I guess, 7 to 9%, maybe a little more, a little less, they provide pretty good yield. And you can, I guess, what do you leverage them at? With bank money at what, 4% in that range?
That's exactly it. So I'm able to pay investors a little bit more because, especially right now, bank money is so cheap. It is in that 3.5 to 4% range. I'm able to get 7-year terms on some of these to make sure they're more secure. So therefore, when people partner with me, I mean, the cash on cash on some of these properties, especially if I can get up in that 9-10% range that they're getting, I mean, we're cracking 20% on some of these that they're able to achieve, which I don't want to say that's, you know, across the board. There's definitely, you know, lower ones that are more conservative and longer term. But yeah, it's really good returns if you're able to leverage it with that 70% bank financing.
How do you structure these type of deals with investors? If I were to come into you and say, I like working with you, let's do a deal together. So you find a property at a, you know, 8 cap. Are they triple net lease typically, most of the industrial?
So I have some that are full gross leases. And that's usually when you get into the more, like the government tenants really like that kind of stuff, or government contractors. I have two different buildings, you know, that I lease to them, and they just like being able to write one check. I have others that are absolute triple net leases where, I mean, if the roof caves in, they're paying for them. So it does spread the gamut a little bit there. But I normally, what you're running into is they will repair anything inside the building, anything that has to do with their stuff. And then they pay all the utilities, sometimes the taxes, and then the owner's responsible for the exterior. So if something goes wrong with the roof or with the parking lot, you know, then I'm responsible for that. So, you know, kind of like anything else, there's definitely a mix of class. As far as how people partner with me, I do that in several different ways. A lot of times it's people investing through their IRAs. So it's retirement funds that they're using to put in these properties and really kind of juice their returns that way, tax-free. And they're limited on the percentage that they're able to have from an equity standpoint, just because we are getting bank financing as well. So a lot of times that's capped at that 20% mark. So they'll invest in up to that point. And if they want to get investing more money in a property, we'll actually do a preferred return on it. So they're just earning a straight interest on the property, or interest on their money, I'm sorry, without, you know, going above that 20% threshold. I have other lenders that they don't want the equity position. They just want to know, hey, I'm making X number of dollars on this property. On their money. And so what we do with that is it's not a partnership. There's no limited partner, general partner set up on those. We will just do a second deed of trust behind the bank on the property, securing their interest. And I'm buying these things, you know, usually at a good price. So there's plenty of equity in it and cash flow to pay the first and the second on that. And then they just get a straight return back to their IRA every single month. Or if they want to compound it, they can just leave it in and we can do it that way as well. So a lot of different ways to structure these. And really, I had that conversation. It's all about listening to, just like if I'm buying a house or I'm buying a property, I have the exact same conversation with the lenders and people that I partner with, because I really got to find out what are their goals? Like, what's their time horizon on that they want this money back? What's their risk tolerance? How much are they looking to invest? You know, all of those same questions and make sure that we're a good fit. Because some people can have expectations or things they're looking for that I'm not their best person to provide that. And I let them know that right up front. Hey, you know, we're just not gonna be a good fit at this time, but let's stay in touch and see if anything changes.
Yeah, makes sense. So a couple of quick comments. Do banks allow the junior liens on these type of properties, essentially?
The banks do allow junior liens on these types of properties, as long as you have the DCR, the debt coverage ratio, to afford that. So banks are looking for a total DCR of 1.2. And that basically just means that, let's say the property makes $100,000 of net income per year. I'm sorry, $120,000 of net income per year, there can only be $100,000 of debt service. So there has to be 1.2 times the debt service as an NOI, for the net operating income. And I'm usually, you know, well clear of that.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that. DCR or DSCR is another way to put it, debt service coverage ratio. It's the common. And yeah, 1.2 is the, I guess I've seen more aggressive lenders can go 1.15, but 1.2 or better is kind of the standard for most of the stuff. But that's actually good to hear. Well, that sort of means that you can't really have really expensive second. I mean, meaning that you, whatever the second is, what are the terms typically you pay on second? So the first is pretty clear. It's 3.5 to 4. Just curious, what's the typical?
Yeah, and typical is, again, there's so many points. I will say the range that I have out right now for interest is anywhere from 4%. I have a small one at up to 12%. Right in the middle there, that 8% range is about the average of what I have for a second position loan right now. It just varies on the property. You know, how soon do they need the money back? I do flips on industrial building as well, where I'll buy them and then resell them. And so those I'm willing to pay more money on, because the money is not going to be out. So like their money, they won't be earning interest all the time. Whereas other people, if they know, hey, I have a really lock solid investment here, it's secure, there's plenty of equity, and I'm getting 8% 365 days a year, and I don't have to think about it. They're really happy with that. And especially if they're doing some kind of tax-free strategy or tax deferred strategy.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that. And that's sort of what I thought, because otherwise if you had a hard money like rates. I mean, generally, mass debt, you know, if you went to me, I wouldn't be interested in 8%. But if you find an individual investor that is comfortable with that, and they get to know, like, and trust you, they can write you a check at 8%. I think that becomes a you would flow within the DSCR. But if you had a 12-13% money, maybe it would get tight. So.
It does. And that would have to be a very, you know, a very small portion. I needed some type of coverage. But if I get into where I'm starting that kind of money, or where I'm going to be paying those kind of rates, it's either very short term or a small deal, and I'm tied up somewhere else at the moment.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. When you take equity investors, I'm just curious, do you pay them a pref on a split, or how do you, you know, just from the equity side?
And that varies as well. If it's a straight, equity partner where we're putting in the same amount of money into the property and, you know, in proportion to what their percentage is, they are just the way I've been doing it is they're just a straight equity. So they get the same return on the property that I do. If it runs in a situation where they want to put in more than if they're doing it through the only time we'll do like a pref again, is if it's out like an IRA and they're at that 20% limit. So now they're an equity partner and they're getting the same return on the property that I do. From the same percentage, but then they also get a pref on whatever additional funds that they put in.
Yeah, it makes sense. So the first scenario where they basically co-invest, it's almost like, why would you want to take co-GP, co-partner? You know, what value do they add to the project if you're running all the work? So that's the reason usually the GP, you're the GP, you're the general partner. needs to get some kind of promote on their money, not just straight, you know, hey, if you put 50% of the capital, I put 50% of the capital, we're both earning the same return. I mean, that would have to be kind of a genuinely true partnership where they're involved.
And you're right on that. So I've modified the way I do these partnerships over the years. So the one you described there, I'm putting up 50% of mine, they're putting 50% of the money. When I'm bringing the deal here, I automatically have 50% of the deal at that point. And so for me, if they're bringing in all the money, then it's a 50-50 deal at that point to close on the property.
You're valuing cash at 50% and you're valuing the,
exactly,
the work at 50%.
And I'm still able to pay, pay great returns on that money with that 50% valuation. So yeah, me bringing the deal and then I manage the deal. I secure all the additional bank funding. That's all in my name. I'm one co-signed on all of that. So that's my 50% of the value in the property. And if I have to bring additional cash, that's where it goes into the other 50% of the property that is made up of the cash portion.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. Neither arguing whether it's good or bad. The only two cents I would add, if this was a little bit more institutional deal, they would probably ask for a pref, and then you can have 50-50 split about above the pref. So I've seen the scenarios where there is a pref and a split, but you can take a management fee to compensate for the pref in essence. But okay, it's another conversation.
Yeah, Big Mike, I would love to actually have that, because as I said, I'm feeding off the crumbs. I've only been doing this for probably 3 or 4 years at this point on the commercial side. So I have, a few deals in my belt, and I've learned a lot, but I know there's people who, especially on the multifamily side, they do syndication things and prefs that are much more advanced than I'm doing. And to be honest, my investors are probably making out a lot better than they would have otherwise, because of me not being as experienced as someone like you and knowing those types of financial strategies you can employ.
It's a separate conversation. For the sake of this podcast, we're going to leave where it is, but schedule the time the same way you scheduled, and let's have an offline conversation, see how I can help you with your deal structuring. But this is interesting. I actually like the asset class and the cash flow side of it. Finding cash flow today is hard. This is one of the few remaining asset classes that's still trading at a reasonable cap rates. And because multifamily seems to be compressing. It's too much money chasing fewer deals. And this industrial is a different beast. So let's tangent a little bit. What's the exit strategy in most of them? I mean, you easy to buy. How do you sell? Do you flip them to a local investors? Do you package them together? Say, hey, here's five different assets. We try to sell it to a bigger player. Or most of these owners are like you. They are local investors who are comfortable. So what's your exit strategy typically on these type of assets?
My exit strategy for my going in exit strategy is buy and hold. I'm a long-term hold investor. So I like to have the cash and the principal pay down. Usually I'm planning on a 7-year horizon. So again, I've only been doing this for 4 years. So that's the longest building that I've owned from on the commercial side. Obviously I've done, many houses. And so I like the 7-year strategy, because at that point I can either sell and I have a good bit of equity in the property, or if I did have a partner on that property that at that time, I have significantly more than the 30% equity required in order to do a refinance out and then hold the property, for an additional term if need be. That said, the market has dictated on a couple of properties that I bought recently to flip them. And it wasn't my intention going in. I bought the property. I closed on it to try and lease it out. And then what's happening is bank rates are so low right now that the leasing market is actually struggling right now, because these small time operators, the local businesses, they see bank rates being so low. If they have good credit, they're gonna try to buy right now. And so that's why
you're selling it to your tenants.
I never even actually get a tenant in them, because what happens is I close on it, I put it for lease for a couple of months, and then my broker talks me into putting a price on it that would make me sell it. I put the price on it and they're selling, basically right away. And so
the owner operator, somebody who wants to basically open the shop, but they don't want to lease it. They want to own it.
That's it. So I've had 3 deals in the last 6 months here that's what I've done. I went in intending to lease it. and the leases were never strong enough to compensate for what I could get on the sale side of it. And so that's what I've done. I'm taking those and rolling them, trying to get, you know, things that I can hold longer. But that's my strategy, is long-term hold. And my investors like that as well. The people that I talk to, a lot of times those philosophies, you know, line up on the longer term strategies, as opposed to, I have another set of investors on my house flipping side, and they like the short ones. I mean, they're usually in and out in less than 6 months, you know, higher returns, higher volatility, a little higher risk, to be perfectly honest.
So I completely understand what's driving your sales. If you can't get good enough lease, I mean, you're basically selling it at a cap rate. That's just makes better sense to take the cash and do something better with it. I understood and agreed, but let's take a step back. Depreciation. These warehouses, are you able to get decent depreciation on them? What's a typical? Do you do any kind of accelerated depreciation on them? Or there's nothing to depreciate there? I'm just curious, how does that part work?
Great question there as well. So the depreciation, you know, obviously on anything but multifamily, you know, it is significantly longer. In fact, I don't know exactly what it is. I think it's 37 or 39 years.
39 years typically, yeah.
Thank you. And there's not near as much. So I could do a cost seg study and try and accelerate, you know, some of that, but I find two things. One, I actually like to pay my taxes sooner rather than later. And if I'm able to pay my taxes at the capital gains rate versus the recapitalization rate later on down the road, I expect to be making more money. I'd rather do that now. So I just use the straight depreciation rate, and I don't accelerate. And the cost of doing the cost seg study, it's not that much, but industrial compared to something like an office building or multifamily, you do get significantly less write-off just because it's a big shell in a lot of cases.
Yeah, it makes sense. Don't get me started on the tax. I mean, we can discuss this for a long time. And it's, yeah, a lot of people prefer to pay current interest, current tax rates, as the future tax rates are projected to go higher. From that perspective, your philosophy makes a lot of sense. Let me pay the current low taxes versus the future. But it's like an addiction, though, like a drug. Once you get used to this depreciation and the shielding your income, and using the cash to buy more, it gets hard to people to pay the taxes. But you know what? It's a fair deal. The segregation study if it's got limited upside, then you know why do it? There's an overhead to do it. Number one, number two, yeah, limited value. You can get something out of it. You can count the doorknobs and the locks and all the little things that can sort of still be written off. But interesting on the depreciation side. I guess the income is taxed at the ordinary rates. You said capital gains, but capital gains is on sale. Your NOI minus the depreciation is what you pay taxes on. So.
Yes. I'm paying income on the or income tax on the income received at this time. And again, I'm actually doing my first cost seg study right now on another office building that I'm buying. Whole other interesting class that we get into. But correct me if I'm wrong. When you do the recapitalization of that, that's at an income rate as well.
25. Yeah. If you the recapture.
I'm sorry. Recapture.
Right. So if you get your segregation study done, as far as I know, I'm not CPA, I don't play one on TV, right? So I gotta be careful here. I love the CPAs give you formal, you know, advice or anybody. But in general, whatever depreciation you take today, it shields you from taxes, you know, today. But on the recapture side, as far as I know, it's 25% on the federal level and whatever the you know, state level. That's how it works. But most players, the moment they sell and then they're recapturing, you know what they do. They're immediately looking for another project in the same year to acquire with accelerated depreciation to basically avoid paying the taxes, kick the can down the road until the next project, you know, runs its life cycle. It's almost like you could almost can never stop. And it's like they have expression, people who never sell, they refine till they die, right? And people who actually, that's why people do 1031 exchanges, right? I mean, they don't want to recapture depreciation. So you can either do you could sell, recapture, find another one that gives you just as much or bigger depreciation, and you roll the money. I think it's called tax loss harvesting. It's one of the ways, you know, to put it. But you basically, you're doing pseudo 1031, sell, buy, as long as they give you enough, you know, gain, loss, passive, because it's both are passive activities. If they give you enough, you offset them. Otherwise, people go into 1031, which is, you know, an alternative strategy to that. So,
yes, I'm in the middle of one of those right now. In fact, if anybody has an industrial property that they can, I can get identified before May 3rd in Pennsylvania, I'd love to get a call.
Well, that's one of the drawbacks of 1031 is you got finite timeline. And that's why, you know, not the worst thing in the world if you blow it up even, right? I mean, you enter it, but then you don't find the property on time, then you theoretically, it goes back to the sale transaction, right? As if you sold it.
Yes.
If you find something else to buy, where you can get accelerated depreciation, it doesn't have to be industrial, right? You could do something with a segregation study and get that depreciation. But you could sort of, you know, passive gain, passive loss offset each other and move on. But yeah, if anyone knows a property in the South and Central Pennsylvania, industrial, they should give you a call, huh?
Exactly. Guys, there's so many ways to do this, then it does get so complicated so fast, to be honest. I mean, I feel like every project I take on, I learn 10 new things of ways of doing it. So even just talking to you, I can't wait to re-listen to this so I can go take some notes of what you've been teaching me just in the last half hour.
Thank you, Darren. You're too kind. I really appreciate. So final comments or thoughts, and how would people get a hold of you if they want to either offer you an industrial property in Central Pennsylvania or South Central, or they want to maybe invest with you or just chat with you? What's the best way to get a hold of you? Is that a website?
Yeah, I have a website. So my company is solidgrowthproperties.com. And you can contact me there or email me at Darren, D-A-R-R-E-N, at solidgrowthproperties.com. And I do just love to chat with people about that. So the things you mentioned, investing, selling, buying, whatever, that would be great. I'd love to hear from you. But if you just want to talk about real estate in any way, shape, or form, I learned something from every conversation and would love to hear from anybody in your audience, Big Mike.
Thank you, Darren.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's slot name. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.